This is the second time I've come and done a lesson on Ecclesiastes. The last time I did it was only the first 11 verses, and I had to set up a little groundwork on it. And tonight, we're going to go through the rest of the first chapter, and then from there, we're going to go into the second chapter and actually finish it tonight. The one thing that we came up with last week was the fact that there's a few words used in here which you really got to try to figure out what they mean. And the one which I like the best is Hebel. It's a Greek, it's Hebrew. And what it means is meaningless, vanity. Or you see vanity used in that. This Hebel means that. It has a whole list of different names, futile, breeze, breath. And what they've done is it's hard to define, so they just use vanity, just to keep the same word all the time, vanity, vanity of vanities. Now, like I told you last week, nowhere in Ecclesiastes will you see Solomon's name mentioned. Everybody thinks that Solomon is who they're talking about. And I think it is too, but I'm not going to say that because it doesn't tell you that. But in the first verse of the first chapter, it talks about this person, the preacher, and that's how he refers to himself as the preacher, is the son of David, king of Jerusalem, and king over Israel. Now we're getting ready to start in verse 12 in the first chapter, and he starts out again introducing who he is. He says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And everybody goes, well, who else is that but Solomon? But it doesn't say it. And I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. Now here's another term which is the first time it's used in this thing, and it's going to be used one more time in the readings we're going to do. Done under heaven. What you've seen before, it was done under the sun. And I said, what I sort of interpreted, and a lot of these things were my interpretation, and so don't base it as fact. When he talks about under the sun, he's talking about under his, control, what's underneath where he's living. Under heaven, if you notice, he talks about the Son of Man. And it could mean all completely under heaven, meaning all of earth. And some of the things he looked at. So like I said, it's just maybe it's a big leap that I'm doing, but this is the way that I see it. In chapter 30, I'm reading out of the New King James Version, but every once in a while I'm going to jump over to the NIV because sometimes it makes things clearer to me because I'm not really that sharp. This is... But verse 13, it says, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given the sons of man by which they may be exercised. And in NIV says, I apply my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And what a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. Now to me that was simpler. But maybe I'm missing something. Verse 14 says, I have seen all works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity, or all is Hebel. All is meaningless. All is futile. All is whatever you want it to be. It's just something that you got to look at. It's hard to explain. And it's like grasping for the wind. Have you ever tried to catch the wind? It not easy to do. The only time I've ever seen wind captured is sails of a sailboat, parachutes, things like that. But what he's saying is, this is so hard to understand, it's like trying to catch the wind or try to grab the wind. Verse 15 says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. And what he's saying there is, if something has been bent, you can't make it perfectly straight again. And if it's not there to count, if it's lacking, then you can't number it. It's impossible to number. Verse 16, I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And anybody which is reading this are going to think, well, we're talking about Solomon again. God gave him more wisdom than anybody else was able to get. And that makes you sort of think, that's Solomon who we're talking about. And in verse 17 it says, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind. So I'm trying to understand madness and folly and no wisdom. But it's an impossible task for me to accomplish. The NIV says, then I applied myself to understand, to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is chasing after the wind. Verse 18, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, I think what it really says, the smarter you get and the more you know, the more you really don't want to know, because it is sorrowful. Okay, this next section, that finishes chapter 1. This next section in chapter 2, we are getting into the first 11 verses. We're going to talk about pleasures that we have as people and what he sees as pleasures and what he's accomplished in his life. And you're going to say, we're talking about Solomon again whenever you start hearing some of the descriptions. Verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, and I will test you with mirth, which means happiness or pleasure or something like that, laughter. And therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely, this also was vanity. This was also habel, meaningless, futile. And I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, happiness, what does it accomplish? I threw happiness in there. I shouldn't have. That's just where I had it marked. But if you go over to NIV, it says, laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? So what does pleasure accomplish? Verse 3, he talks about trying to gratify the flesh on some of the things which helps you with enjoyment. And he says, I search in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold of joy on joy till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. And so he's talking like plural again when he's talking their lives instead of his life. Let's read this in the NIV. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their life. And again, to me, that's easier to understand. Now, another pleasure is the fruits of our labors. It says, I made works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. So he talks about all the accomplishments he made. And you think about it, if you go look at Solomon, he went for 13 years, he built his house. He spent 13 years building his house. And he spent 8 or 9 years building the temple. And he did all these improvements and stuff like that. I think about my house I built up in Delta. 6 months, I had it enclosed. 15 years later, I was still working on the yard and things around there. It takes a long time to get what you want. And I think that pretty much tells you what this fellow was doing. He was just, it had to be just right. But think, he had, if he was Solomon, he had access to 153,000 people working for him. A lot of people. And the next thing he talks about, another one of his pleasures, is possessions and gains from his labors. I acquired male and female servants, and I had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. So he's telling you, he had a lot. And then he talks about his singers and special things he had. That's another one of his pleasures. In verse 8, he says, I also gathered for myself silver and gold and special treasures of kings in province. And I acquired male and female singers and delighted the delights of sons of men and musical instruments of all kinds. So he had everything. If he was Solomon, it tells us several places in the Bible. 1 Kings 10:27, 2 Chronicles 1:15, it reads, also the king had silver and gold as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he had cedars as abundant as sycamores, which are in the lowlands. And I think about sycamores as being a form of cottonwood trees. They're plentiful. We call them garbage trees. They're really not good for anything other than shade. But these cedars he's talking about like with the redwoods, the big monstrous redwood trees, because that's what they were noted for, is how large those trees were. Verse 9, it says, so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So he's saying he's accomplished so much, but still I was wise. I still maintained my wisdom. And then the next one of his pleasures, which is the final one that I'm listing, verse 10, it says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep it from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labors, and this was my reward from all my labors. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and all the labors in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity, all was hebel, in grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. You know, and that makes you think of Mark 8:36. You know, for what will it profit a man to gain the whole world but to lose his soul? And I think that's what he's saying here. I've accomplished all these things, but I had nothing. Now, another thing he's trying to satisfy, is to be found in wisdom in verses in chapter 2, 12 through 17 is the next section we're going to go through. Then I turned myself to consider the wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds a king? Only what he has already done. And so what does kings do whenever they follow another king? They follow another king. That's what it's saying. In verse 13 it says, then I saw wisdom excel folly as light excels darkness. So what he's saying is wisdom's better than foolish things. And light is better than darkness. And in verse 14, it says, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happened to them all. And so what he's saying is, these people, they're wise, but there's foolish ones. But at the end, they all end up in the same place. In verse 15, it says, so I said in my heart, as it happened to the fool, it also happened to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. This also is foolish. And in verse 16, for there is no more remembrance of the wise man, of the fool, forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? He dies as a fool. And it's pretty much tells you exactly what it means. Verse 17, it says, therefore I hate life, because the work that was done under the sun, and there's under the sun again, was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. This next section is, there's no satisfaction. You can't be satisfied in work, doing things. And it's verses 18 through 23. Then I hate all my labors in which I have toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to a man who will come after me. So what he's saying, I'm working so hard, and then I'm going to leave, and then somebody else is going to come along, which didn't work for this, and how is he going to treat it? You know, I thought about that. I retired at this one plant. I worked there for 20-some years, and I had a crew, and I had the same crew all the time, and we accomplished things. We started rebuilding pumps faster than anybody else did, and we set all types of records on doing things. And I'm saying, what's going to happen after I leave? Are they going to do better? Are they going to keep this and all that? Well, it turned out they just went back to the old ways. Instead of rebuilding these big, huge pumps in one day, they went back to doing it in a week. It just all changed. And this is what he's worried about. How's this guy going to handle this? And in verse 19 it says, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labors in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. So he's saying, if this guy's a smart guy, it's going to be good. If this guy's not a smart guy, it's not going to be so good. In verse 20, it says, therefore, I turned my heart in despair of all the labors in which I have toiled under the sun. So he's reminiscing. He's looking back at everything he's doing. He's just, what's going to happen to everything that I've accomplished? And in verse 21, it says, for there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. And it's saying the same thing as what the other verses above it said. For what has man for all of his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? It says, that's like saying his hard work gets him worry and all his work means nothing. That's what he's saying there. And then verse 23, it says, for all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. So what he's saying is he worries so much about what he's done and what's going to happen to it that he can't even sleep. And don't know what he's going to do with it. Before I go on, I want to, if you think about the first 11 verses we went over in the first chapter the last time, you could see this preacher, how he talked about what he was doing and how useless it all was. He talked about, you can't do anything about the wind. The wind's going to blow this way and the wind's going to blow that way. You can't stop it. He talks about, day and night and all these things. No matter how wise you are and how smart you are, you can't stop it. It's going to happen. It just goes that way. And now he's getting, I almost think this fellow is, he has his ups and downs. He brags about how much I've done and how much he's accomplished and everything else. And then he's going, it's all useless. All that I've done is useless. It doesn't mean anything. And everybody's going, he says, okay, that's a nice thing that you're going through, and that, how does that apply to us as Christians and what we're doing? If we get into these next verses here, verse 24 through 26, he's going to tell you something other which kind of surprises, and now he's going to bring this out. In verse 24, it says, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? And I think these are saying a real simple thing. Only in God does life have meaning and true pleasure. I mean, that's what he's saying. And without him, nothing will satisfy you. You can't find satisfaction in enjoyment. And true pleasure comes only when you acknowledge that it all does come from God. And in verse 26, it says, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. I was trying to understand this a little bit more and get anything out of it, and then I ran across Psalm 73, and I'm not gonna go through and read it to you, but Psalm 73, it tells you the psalmist, how he looked at people and that was doing so well and accomplishing so much and getting so much in life. And he's sitting here and he's not having that. And he doesn't understand, why is God letting him do that? Why am I not getting things? But he finally gets down here, and I'm going to jump on a little further down in the Psalms and we're going to start with verse 16 of Psalms 73 instead of reading it all. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end. Surely you set them in a slippery place. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they are brought to desolation. As in a moment, they are utterly consumed with terror. As a dream when one awakes. So, Lord, then you awake, You shall despise their image. Thus my heart was grieved, and I was vexed in my mind. I was made foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you, and you hold me by my right hand. You will guide me with your counsel, and afterwards receive me to glory. In verse 25, it says, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For indeed, those who are far from you shall perish. You have destroyed all those who desert you to heritage. But it is good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord God, that I may declare all your works. I think in Psalms and also in Ecclesiastes, what we read, I think you can see very clearly that the preacher realized how important God was, that it all came from him, and it all was accomplished that way. And I think about us in our life. I know, I've seen a thing, I like to watch these preachers on these different channels and that. I mean, there's whole bunches of them. But anyway, they had this one preacher, and he was standing up there in front of the audience they had there, and he was talking about how God blessings are given to you. And he says, put your hands out in front of you. And he says, now we're going to put these blessings in your hands. And he says, he gives you the blessing of a good job, a house, your family, your wife, your children, food to eat, your clothes you wear, the comfort, your health, and everything. And he says, now your hands are getting filled. He says, well, don't close it. Keep that hands open. Keep your hands open with all these blessings from God so that everybody else can see them and so that they realize that this is what God's given you. This is what we have to realize as Christians. Think of the blessings we have. I sit and I say, I have everything in my life. I've never regretted anything which, you know, I've done. I've made mistakes, but I learn from them. I know that everything that I have comes from God. I know he's always there with us. Everybody knows I just went through a health issue thing, and I'm happy. I'm a happy person. I'm pleased. I'm pleased with the life that God's given me. And I think every one of us need to be too. What does he want from us? He wants us to love him and care for him. He wants us to be willing to give him a little bit of time of our life. It's so hard for Christians to come to church 3 times a week, 3 or 4 hours, you know, out of a week. You got 7 days in a week, and there's 24 hours in a day, and we can't even give 3 hours or 4 hours a week to God. And he gives us everything. He gave us his son. And the one wonderful thing about him too is never do you have to worry about asking him for something there, because he's always willing to give it to you. He loves us. He cares for us. You know he loves you. He let his son come to this earth and suffer and die on the cross for you. And it's what? Who else can you find which loves you more than that? But this time is when I would say you'd do the invitation, but everybody is pretty much a member, I'm sure. But he's also here to forgive. If you do have any sins or any problems in your life, or you need the prayers of the congregation, or you want him to forgive you or something,
All you have to do is ask, and he'll give it to you. So at this time, if you do have any needs, as we sing the invitation song, the opportunity is yours at this time.